From Wyoming to Virginia, Hawaii to Alabama, this is American Radio Journal. On this edition, as Congress considers rooting out waste, fraud, and abuse in the Medicaid system, scare tactics and misinformation abound. We'll get the facts from Nina Schaefer of the Heritage Foundation. Congress took a major step forward in the reconciliation process that will give President Donald Trump his one big beautiful bill. Scott Parkinson from the Club for Growth is here with the real story. You thought alcohol prohibition was something that ended a century ago, but now the new prohibitionists are hijacking federal dietary guidelines. Eric Boehm of Reason Magazine reports. And the annual Rich States, Poor States report is out. And Jonathan Williams from the American Legislative Exchange Council has details on this week's American Radio Journal commentary. I'm Loman Henry, and welcome to American Radio Journal. As part of congressional efforts to pass the One Big Beautiful Bill to preserve the Trump tax cuts, reforms to the Medicaid system are under consideration. The left has responded with scare tactics and misinformation. Nina Schaefer is director of the Center for Health and Welfare Policy at the Heritage Foundation. She is here to set the record straight. Nina, welcome back to American Radio Journal. Nina, we have Medicare and we have Medicaid, two very different programs. We're going to talk about Medicaid today. Give us a little bit of background on what these two programs are and what the differences are.
Sure. I think the most obvious difference is that the Medicare program is pretty much a universal program for those people over the age of 65. It covers some disabled, but the vast majority of people will know of Medicare as the healthcare program for retirees. Medicaid is almost the opposite. It's a targeted program for certain low-income people in the country. And so it is really not as uniform as Medicare, where everyone's over 65. On Medicaid, you have children, you have the low-income elderly, low-income disabled, some low-income parents, and people that are just childless adults with that don't have any disability. So it's a real mix of a population, which makes it a very complicated program.
As Congress is working here on the One Big Beautiful Reconciliation Bill, Nina, there's been a lot of messaging from the left that the goal of the legislation, the goal of the Trump administration, is to take away benefits from the Medicaid program. As we look at this, is that just a lot of fear-mongering?
It really is. I think the whole intent is that many on the left don't want anything to change in Washington, and that's certainly not the message that the American people sent this last election. And so I think that looking through it in a more serious lens is to say, look, we've had government programs. The Medicaid program, for example, has been in existence since 1965. And, you know, when you have a program that's been around that long, sometimes it's good to kind of take a look under the hood and see what's going on. And so there are some, I think, very practical things that could be done within the Medicaid program that will actually shore it up and make it more stable and more and stronger for people who need it. Right now, the way the program is operating and the way many liberals want to use the program is, let's just keep putting more people on the boat. The problem is, the more people we keep putting on the boat and the more that you're asking of the boat, the faster it's going to sink. And so really, there's a different way of looking at this. And I think that the fear-mongering on the left is actually not helpful at all and really just underscores that all they really want to do is preserve the status quo.
In terms of changes we could look at, can you talk maybe for a minute or two about any specific areas that we should be considering changes in?
This is just one that's so obvious to me. So during passage of the Affordable Care Act, Congress added a new population. As I said, there are different populations that can join Medicaid. And to entice the states to actually add that population, they raised the federal contribution to the states. So the federal government would assume a larger share of the cost. Well, that might, I mean, I disagreed with it at the time, but even at the time, one could argue, okay, that is something that you might want to do to kind of get a new population and get the states active. The problem is we're in the past 10 years of Obamacare, and we're still trying to entice states after 10 years to add people to the population. I think that is one area where Congress could look at, because in the traditional population, so children, elderly, the disabled, those people get a much different match rate from the federal government than this new population. And I think equalizing those two would be one area that would bring some sensible reform to the program and begin to level the playing field in the Medicaid program.
Did we see a surge in enrollees in this program during COVID, Nina? Is that still impacting the system?
Oh, yes. That's another great example. So during COVID, not unexpected, but we saw a lot of people lose their jobs. And so then they became eligible because of their income levels for the Medicaid program. Congress added additional dollars to help offset those costs during the emergency to the states. But the trick was they told the states, if you take this money, you cannot redetermine eligibility for these people. So once they're on, they're locked in until the funding goes away. That created all sorts of distortions into the Medicaid program. So we saw a surge of Medicaid enrollment, not to be unexpected, but then the numbers never came down because the money was still coming in from the federal government. The federal government finally turned off the spigot, and we have seen some of a decline, but the Biden administration used that as a tool to just keep people on the program. Their long-term goal is not to have just eligible people. As I said, they really just want to dump more and more people onto this government program for a lifetime. And so I think that there is a lot that could be done to kind of roll back what the Biden administration did, as well as to make sure that the states are doing their job and making sure that only those people who are eligible for the program remain on the program. That would be another very common sense policy change.
Another area to look at here, Nina, is waste, fraud, and abuse. The three of them seem to go together all the time. As we move toward the reconciliation bill in Congress, do you expect that there will be direction or included in legislation or somehow an effort to root out waste, fraud, and abuse, which really is taking away money from people who actually need it?
The fraud, waste, and abuse is really the lowest hanging fruit. There are so many funding mechanisms and gimmicks that states use, but also people who accept the Medicaid, meaning providers who provide the care to Medicaid beneficiaries, kind of manipulate the system to their advantage. There is a lot that could be done just to find some low-hanging fruit in the system and start to kind of bring better governance to the Medicaid program. I think that is very similar to what the DOGE efforts are trying to do internally within the administration. There's a lot that the Congress could learn, perhaps, from what DOGE is finding and actually put that into statutory change so it's actually locked in and we're not just spinning our wheels over keeping everything the way it is.
I would imagine this has had a big impact on state budgets as well, since states contribute to the program.
It has. And, that's one of the issues and some of the, I think one of the efforts that's going to have to happen here in Washington is bringing the states in now and start working with them on how can we reset the Medicaid program so that it's fiscally sustainable, not just for the federal taxpayers, but also state taxpayers, and do it in a way that still preserves the program and ensures that we have a strong and a strong safety net for those low-income people who need the program.
We have been talking with Nina Schaefer, who is director of the Center for Health and Welfare Policy at the Heritage Foundation. Nina, tell us a little bit about the Heritage Foundation. You have a recent report on this issue. Where can folks find that on the web?
Thank you so much for having me. The Heritage Foundation is a conservative think tank with principles that are based on sound policy. You can find our research at www.heritage.org, and my report is called Common Sense Medicaid Reforms for 2025.
Nina Schaefer of the Heritage Foundation. Nina, thank you for being with us.
Thanks a lot.
Scott Parkinson at the Club for Growth. All of the action is on Capitol Hill. All eyes on the reconciliation process. It's moving along. A big step last week. Scott Parkinson's going to explain it for us. Scott, good to have you here.
Great to be back, Loman. Thank you.
What was the major development that has occurred within the last few days?
Well, late last week, the House of Representatives held a negotiation with Speaker Mike Johnson and Senate Majority Leader John Thune. And really, these House conservatives were looking for a commitment and a promise from the leadership to do everything possible and make sure that the big, beautiful one bill reconciliation bill that President Trump wants on his desk in the coming months includes some fiscal restraint at minimum of $1.5 trillion in spending cuts. And this negotiation basically provided for reconciliation instructions, if you think about like the contours of what a bill can and cannot include. And they said that at a minimum, it should include $4 billion. Well, that's a big difference between $1.5 trillion and $4 billion. And so these House Republicans were really concerned that they were not going to get the fiscal cuts. They got a negotiation that resulted in John Thune and Mike Johnson holding a joint press conference, committing to doing everything possible to get that spending reduction into law. And ultimately, that resulted in the House passing the Senate resolution and having the votes to really move forward with the reconciliation legislation, because you need a concurrent budget resolution to move forward, which means the same budget has to pass the House and Senate. So we've got that now, and that means that the real negotiations for the tax bill can begin.
Now that we're at this stage in the process, Scott, with negotiations underway, what happens from here? What is the timing? What are the next steps in the process?
I think over the next couple of weeks, you'll see the committees getting together, not just the Ways and Means Committee and the Senate Finance Committee, but other committees that are instructed to cut spending will get together as well. And they will come to an agreement on what they think they can achieve through committee. But what's important here, I think, to understand is, you know, you have promises that Republicans have included in the party platform. You know, I'm confident that we've got the momentum right now to build a big, beautiful bill that will make a big difference when it comes to economic growth, when it comes to fiscal restraint, and when it comes to really fulfilling those campaign promises that built the majorities we have in the House, Senate, and winning the White House.
Republicans, of course, are wanting to make sure that we preserve the tax cuts from the first Trump administration. But Scott, over the last week or so, the idea has arisen of possibly raising the highest marginal tax rate. Is that idea under serious consideration here?
Well, listen, I think that it's been reported that there was a Senate conference meeting where the option was put on the table. And members talked about it, and of course that leaked to the media, and the media has run with it because it's a very divisive issue between Republicans that do not want to see any rate increase on individuals, and others that are looking for sort of options to be on the table to do other things. And from Club for Growth's perspective, keeping the top rate at 37% is a red line. We've communicated this publicly, and Club would issue a key vote alert to members of Congress which opposed any legislation that attempted to increase the top individual marginal rate by any amount, to be honest. Club wants to see the repeal of all tax provisions from the Inflation Reduction Act. You remember when Biden did those clean energy tax credits that cost us $880 billion? We want to get rid of those. We want to get rid of the 1% tax on stock buybacks. We want to get rid of the 15% minimum tax on corporate book income. And, you know, we also want to see things ultimately it's a Club position for the last 25 years to abolish the death tax, the estate tax, oppose expanding refundable tax credits. Various things like that, I think, need to be talked about. You know, if listeners want to call their member of Congress and really, weigh in on what's important to them when it comes to tax policy, extending and expanding the Trump 2017 tax cuts is the game in town right now in Washington, D.C. And this is going to be a game that we play over the next 6 to 12 weeks at minimum.
How important is it, Scott, that Congress get this done? Is this going to be a make or break for the second Trump administration, getting this actually over the finish line?
Well, the budget resolution itself would provide for the ability to increase the debt limit by, I think, $5 trillion is what made it into the Senate resolution. And that sounds like an outrageous amount to anybody that cares about our debt and deficit situation. That's why the fiscal hawks want to see deficit reduction included in this bill. But what that means by including the debt limit in the reconciliation instructions, it means that we're looking at trying to get this bill done by the middle of June. We've also got, you know, tax day happened this week, so revenues might come in a little higher, which could push that so-called X date back. And, you know, President Trump is out there, I think, leading on this issue. And so we're going to be watching really closely from the club's offices in Washington to make sure that our 525,000 members from all 50 states are represented in this fight.
Certainly a lot of moving parts here, and we are going to keep very close tabs on this over the next few weeks with Scott Parkinson from the Club for Growth. You did tell us a bit about the club, but tell us a bit more, Scott, also, where can folks find you on the web?
The club is united in this idea of economic freedom, liberty, and opportunity. Listeners can check us out at clubforgrowth.org, and you can actually sign up to become a member for free.
Scott Parkinson at the Club for Growth. Scott, thank you for being with us.
You're welcome.
A review of federal dietary guidelines is underway, and alcohol consumption has surprisingly become an issue. We get details now from Eric Boehm of Reason Magazine.
Hi, I'm Eric Boehm with Reason Magazine. You know, every week on this program, I bring on different guests to talk about things that they've written, things that they're discussing, stories that they're telling. But this week, I want to do a little bit of self-promotion, if I can, and talk about a story that I've written. It's the cover story, actually, in the latest issue of Reason Magazine, and it's now out from behind the paywall at Reason.com as well. The headline on the piece is "The New Prohibitionists Who Are Hijacking the Federal Dietary Guidelines." It's a story that starts with something that you're almost certainly familiar with. And once you heard the words federal dietary guidelines, it's probably the thing that popped into your head. I'm talking about the food pyramid. Now, if you're somebody like me who grew up in the 1990s, or if you had kids who did, you almost certainly remember the food pyramid. It was everywhere. It was on the back of cereal boxes. It was in public service announcements, on cafeteria walls, all over the place. So the food pyramid, it was developed as part of the federal government's dietary guidelines, and these things are revamped and published every 5 years by the U.S. Department of Agriculture and the Department of Health and Human Services working together. The food pyramid itself is actually no longer part of those recommendations. It sort of fell out of favor back in the mid-2000s, but here we are. It's 2025, and these things are done every 5 years, so that means it's time for the next round of the federal dietary guidelines to be developed. And this year, the big fight is maybe not one that's on the front page of most newspapers, but the big fight is happening over alcohol. And in the lead up to this year's finalization of those new guidelines, the U.S. Department of Agriculture and the Department of Health and Human Services have subverted the long established process in developing the guidelines. And what they've done instead, they did this last year during the Biden administration, is they handed some outsized influence to a handful of scientists who are not experts in nutrition science at all, but people who have a long track record of advocating for the government to restrict drinking, to restrict alcohol. And for the purposes of our conversation today, we'll focus on just one of those people. We'll focus on a guy named Tim Naimi. In the piece, you'll find a number of quotes going back through the years where I establish pretty clearly that Naimi is one of the world's foremost advocates for reducing drinking, and not just reducing it on a personal level, but having the government do it for you. For example, in 2023, he said, "This is about more than asking individuals to consider cutting down on their drinking. Yes," he went on to say, "that can be important, but governments need to make changes to the broader drinking environment." At the time, he was helping to draft a 2023 report from the Canadian Center on Substance Use and Addiction that called for updating that country's dietary guidelines to advise significantly less drinking, as little as 2 drinks per week. It also advocated for higher taxes on booze and more warning labels. That proposal generated a lot of headlines. You may actually remember seeing some headlines at the time about it, but it was never actually adopted by the government in Canada. But now last year, as the Biden administration was putting together the advisory committee that would begin the process of rewriting America's dietary guidelines, it tapped Naimi to lead that group. And it also made another weird choice that's worth mentioning here. It put the entire review process under the purview of something called the Interagency Coordinating Committee for the Prevention of Underage Drinking. Yes, that's a mouthful. We'll just call it ICPUD for now. That's a federal entity that was created back in 2004 to coordinate all federal activities related to the problem of underage drinking. And now what you're probably thinking is, wait a minute, the dietary guidelines have nothing to do with underage drinking. The recommended amount of alcohol for Americans under age 21 is zero. So this was an unprecedented maneuver where the Biden administration effectively extended ICPUD's mandate to include not just underage drinking, but the amount of alcohol that should be consumed by legal adults. And who did ICPUD, this federal entity, choose to lead the new committee to make those recommendations? Of course, it picked Tim Naimi. And he's not the only anti-alcohol activist on the panel. He's also been joined by Kevin Shield, who leads an advisory panel on addiction at the World Health Organization, which in 2023 updated its stance on alcohol to recommend that there is no safe level of alcohol consumption. And we won't bother going through the rest of the roster, but the important thing to note here is that there's nobody on the committee who is a dietitian or an expert nutritionist. Instead, these are all people who are experts in mental health and epidemiology. One is an expert in anesthesiology. They are people who have studied addiction and alcoholism. They're not people who have studied nutrition, which you would think would form the backbone of the federal dietary guidelines. Now, Naimi's biggest claim to fame is a 2023 study that forms the backbone of that no safe level claim. But when you dig into that study, as I did for this piece, you'll find that the data there actually show that moderate drinking has almost no effect whatsoever on life expectancy. The statistically significant change in life expectancy is for men who have an average of 3 drinks per day and women who have more than 2. So in other words, that study, the one that he's most famous for having produced, it actually seems to confirm the existing dietary guidelines, which advise no more than 2 drinks per day. It does not seem to demand that they be changed. Now, of course, routinely drinking a lot of alcohol can be dangerous to one's health. We know that pretty clearly. Drinking less than a moderate or large amount of alcohol, unsurprisingly, is not as bad. But there are, of course, trade-offs that come with those decisions, like there are for anything else that you consume, and like legal adults should be free to make. This might all seem something like common sense, and on some level, it is. But the point of this story is that there's a well-organized campaign now positioned to embed a very different set of conclusions into the government's official dietary guidance. There's a lot more to this story. We're out of time, unfortunately, for today, but I hope you'll head over to Reason.com and check out the rest of it. Again, that's the cover story on the latest issue of Reason Magazine, written by yours truly, Eric Boehm. You can find it there. The headline is "The New Prohibitionists Are Hijacking Federal Dietary Guidelines." I hope you'll check it out there on the website or in the print magazine, and I also hope you'll join me right back here next week on another edition of American Radio Journal.
The 2025 Rich States, Poor States report is out. And co-author Jonathan Williams from the American Legislative Exchange Council talks about it on this American Radio Journal commentary.
Earlier this week, the American Legislative Exchange Council published the 2025 Economic Outlook Rankings and the annual Rich States, Poor States report. For 18 years now, I've worked with my co-authors, Dr. Arthur Laffer and Steve Moore, to report on the 15 policy variables which are critical to economic competitiveness in the states. The report began with a very simple idea that our federalist system created by our founders has enabled a great economic experiment. With 50 states and 50 different economic policy environments, there'll be distinct competitive differences across the country. Americans and businesses with the freedom to relocate and the technology to make it easier vote with their feet. They move from those places with burdensome regulations and high taxes to others that provide them with the most economic opportunity. The 15 policy variables we have used in rich states, poor states, are those that are both under the control of states' lawmakers and also those that have the greatest impact on economic outlook, and thus where individuals and businesses choose to locate. For 18 consecutive years, the state of Utah has held the top spot for economic outlook. This does not come because the state has stayed the same. Indeed, it's often found over the years that states can fall behind simply by standing still. Utah's number one ranking is held because of a relentless commitment from the state's leaders to not rest on their laurels, but to continue improving the state's competitiveness year after year. Across a range of policy areas, solutions like truth in taxation for property taxes, pension reform, Financial Ready Utah that monitors federal funds and prepares for their downturn, the flat tax, and fiscally responsible spending have helped the state earn and keep its number one economic outlook. Other states have followed Utah's lead on many of these successful policies. Most recently, with Kansas adopting a flat personal income tax just last week, and Mississippi lawmakers also recently passed a complete phase-out of their personal income tax. The results for Utahns have been clear. The Beehive State has had the fastest GDP and fastest job growth in the country from 2013 to 2023. On the opposite end of the spectrum, for 16 of the 18 editions of Rich States, Poor State, in the report we released earlier this week, New York has ranked 50 out of 50 again. The state is home to the highest personal and corporate income tax rates in the country, the fourth highest property tax burden, and countless other uncompetitive policies. The results of this approach should send a clear message to policymakers elsewhere. From 2013 to 2023, the state has lost nearly 2 million residents on net to the other 49 states. Americans and businesses are voting with their feet against New York's policies, many of them headed to more competitive states like Florida. The Sunshine State, despite having more than 3 million residents more than New York, spends roughly half of what New York spends on state government. This proves that taxes borne by New Yorkers and residents of other high-tax, uncompetitive states support excessive and wasteful government spending. While leaders in New York have continually chosen to increase taxes, chasing higher revenues even as residents flee, Florida has delivered tax cuts to support a growing economy and population. Tennessee, like Florida, is one of the 9 states to levy no tax on personal income. In the report, it has proven to be one of the most important policy variables. The Volunteer State made out as one of the biggest improvements this year's rankings, moving from number 12 to number 2 for economic outlook. But the big winner in the rankings this year, moving up an incredible 13 ranks in economic outlook to number 18, was Louisiana. Governor Jeff Landry and legislative leaders passed transformational reform with a 3% flat tax in a state that's long been an economic laggard in the ultra-competitive Southeast region. While they still have room to improve, the Louisiana comeback is clearly underway. Well, that's a quick snapshot of our 18th edition of Rich States, Poor States and a few of the key stories that impact hardworking taxpayers across America. For more information and to see how your state ranks, visit richstatespoorstates.org. For American Radio Journal, I'm Jonathan Williams. Thanks for listening.
American Radio Journal is heard on public affairs-minded radio stations all across the country, including WNMB AM and FM in Myrtle Beach, South Carolina, along with WHAI FM in Greenfield, Massachusetts. American Radio Journal is produced weekly by the Lincoln Institute of Public Opinion Research, Incorporated. The Lincoln Institute is completely funded through the generosity of individuals, corporations, and philanthropic foundations which underwrite the costs of this program. Comments and opinions expressed on this program are those of the guests and do not necessarily reflect the views of the Lincoln Institute or of this radio station. Learn more about American Radio Journal and hear expanded versions of some interviews aired on this program. Please visit our website AmericanRadioJournal.com. I'm Loman Henry. Thank you for listening to American Radio Journal. American Radio Journal, lighting the brush fires of freedom.